From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A firestorm right now over the shooting of the gorilla in the Cincinnati Zoo when a boy fell into its cage. It's a particularly dramatic case for questions of animal rights. But my guest today, Wayne Pacelli, head of the Humane Society of the United States, sees a bigger picture of these rights and human reluctance to harm taking hold like never before. People no longer want to buy things or entertainments based on cruelty to animals, he said. He says, this hour On Point, entering the humane economy. And yes, we will talk about the gorilla. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you look around and see a humane economy emerging? Is it close to mainstream? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. His new book is The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Wayne Pacelli, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Since it's this day of all days and you're here, let me ask you first about Cincinnati and the zoo and the gorilla that was shot after the four-year-old boy clambered around at the outskirts and then fell into its cage. You're head of the Humane Society. Was that the right call?
Well, it was certainly a tough call. It was a horrible, horrible outcome, that beautiful gorilla, and to see his strength. And he was never, you know, he had never done anything to warrant this situation. This was thrust upon him by the action of a little boy who didn't know any better. You know, I think, you know, you look at this situation, obviously the gorilla can kill the boy in a flash. Mm-hmm. To me, he was exhibiting gorilla-type behavior, and I think it would have been odd for him to take a lethal or harmful action against the boy. I wish he had been tranquilized instead. But, you know, when you're in the heat of the moment, you can certainly understand. And it really is a lifeboat scenario. A lot of people think, oh, my God, it's the boy or the gorilla. And, you know, what I talk about in my book and what I talk about broadly is that, generally speaking, we do not have moral conflicts between animals and humans. We can just choose to help animals, and it won't harm us in any way. But, you know, we feel really horrible about what happened to that gorilla, but we certainly understand the really quick action that needed to be taken one way or another.
Here's the director of the Cincinnati Zoo. This is Thane Maynard on Sunday, saying he had no choice on Saturday after the four-year-old fell into the gorilla enclosure.
The reason that tranquilizing was not chosen is in an agitated situation, which the male was, it may take quite a while for a tranquilizer to take effect. But certainly, at the instant he would be hit, he would have a dramatic response. You don't hit it and he falls over. I mean, it would take a few minutes. The child wasn't under attack, but all sorts of things could happen in a situation like that.
Wayne Pacelli, you're head of the Humane Society, and I didn't really hear an answer, right or wrong call. We know it was a terrible decision to have to make, but there are 300,000-plus people now saying it was wrong. Where do you stand?
I wouldn't have chosen to shoot the gorilla. We have a number of animal care facilities at the Humane Society of the United States. Obviously, protocols need to be in place to handle these situations. Again, the director of the zoo said the boy was not under attack. And,
As you say, he could have been killed.
No question.
In
no
a moment.
Question.
But even if with the child's life potentially on the line, you would not have shot the gorilla?
Well, I don't think that the child's life was on the line in terms of an attack. Clearly, the gorilla had the potential to do that. I think it's a terrible case, and I would not have made that choice, but I understand why the zoo did so.
You've got a much bigger picture that you're addressing. I mean, that was terrible, but you've got a really worldwide picture that you're talking about in your book, The Humane Economy. And you make the case that the old way of doing things, which would often be almost oblivious to animal suffering, is really changing. Can you give us a handful of examples of where you see, we'll dive into the fundamental dynamics, but where do you see the evidence for that claim?
The evidence is all around us, Tom. First, the food industry, the biggest names in food retail, Walmart, McDonald's, Kroger, Safeway, almost every big name brand you can think of within the last few years, and many of them within the last 9 months, have made commitments to change their purchasing practices and their supply chain to source animal products from farms that don't confine the animals so severely in gestation crates or battery cages for laying hens that essentially physically immobilize the animals. Not just a couple of companies, 175 of them, just about every big-name brand. The 25 biggest grocery chains in the U.S., except one, Publix, have all made this commitment in the last 9 months in sourcing just cage-free eggs. A second domain is the use of live animals in entertainment. SeaWorld in March announced with the Humane Society of the U.S. that it would end its breeding of orcas after decades of basically hinging their business model around these theatrical displays with orcas. And Ringling Brothers on May 1st, again, another iconic live entertainment company in terms of live entertainment with animals, said it's retiring its traveling elephant acts and is putting the animals at its facility in Florida. You know, we see hundreds of companies that are now not testing their products on animals. We saw 45 airlines after the tragic killing of Cecil the lion last July say that they will not ship the trophies of lions, leopards, elephants, rhinos, or Cape Buffalo. So in different sectors of the economy where animals have been kind of embedded in those different uses of animals, we're seeing big changes. Not everything is changing. We still have immense problems. But for me, the evidence is major forward progress.
What's on the other side of that ledger? I mean, you write that there has never been such widespread and determined concern for the welfare of animals from the Humane Economy, your book. But you also say, and yet we humans mete out pain and toil on animals on a scale unseen, indeed unimagined before. So what's the net here?
Well, we don't see it, which is part of the problem. I mean, we saw that poor gorilla shot this weekend, and, you know, it's vivid for us. It's alive. We can kind of put ourselves in that situation. We can try to do some of our own moral problem solving. But for so many forms of animal use and abuse, we're deeply disassociated. The biggest use, Tom, is, of course, the use of animals for food. There are 9 billion animals raised in the United States for food every year. That's land animals, 77 billion worldwide. The average American eats 30 animals a year. And, you know, we talk about this case with the boy and the gorilla. Well, we have choices with our food every day where it's not a life or death choice for us. We can just choose to eat a plant-based product and save an animal's life if we choose to go that route. We know it's healthy for us. We know so much of that food is palatable. And, you know, if you look at all the different areas that where animals are exploited, so much of it happens far from our view. The trophy hunters, you know, this Minnesota dentist went to Zimbabwe and shot the lion. It was only because of social media and because of established media and the fact that he took a picture with his guide smiling over the slain lion that the world learned about it. This is what's happening in the internet era and in the information age, is that we're now really telling the backstory of what's happening. And we as a society generally have a value system that cruelty to animals is wrong. Well, if we do have that value system, then we must act upon it.
I can see all kinds of ways in which you're making progress. You describe them there. When you say Humane Economy, what does that ultimately mean to you? I know you're vegan, maybe the first vegan head of the Humane Society. Does it ultimately mean, because I ask you and the first thing you come back with is 9 billion animals raised for food in this country, 77 billion worldwide, does it mean a vegetarian world?
Well, I think that, you know, we take a pluralistic approach at the Humane Society of the United States. We embrace that lifestyle of vegetarian and veganism for a lot of our members. As you indicated, I've been a vegan for quite a long time. But we have most of our members are omnivores. And I think our metric is progress.
Meaning their diet includes meat.
Exactly. Our metric is progress, not perfection. We want people making conscious choices. If you don't go all the way on it, you just go some of the way, that's great. We celebrate that. We have a program called Meatless Mondays. If people just abstain from eating meat one day a week, that would save about 1.4 billion animals a year just by going meatless one day a week. And it would be better outcomes for us, for the environment, the health of the planet. You know, it's not a sacrifice these days when you have thousands of edible plants. We've got so many products in the marketplace that mimic the taste and texture of meat. You can kind of get whatever you want these days. It's easier than ever. But I would say, you know, our ultimate goal is people consciously thinking about our human relationship to animals. That means in the food system, in the world of fashion, in the world of science and research and development, in the world of wildlife management, live entertainment. We want people alert to the issue of animal suffering and to recognize that these animals have their own lives that matter to them. There's so much literature in the way of animal cognition intelligence. There are a bunch of books out. I've got my book out, which is not a science-based book. It's more about economics. But Jennifer Ackerman has a book now about the intelligence of birds.
Just talked to her, yeah.
Yeah, Carl Safina has a book about animal intelligence. Franz De Waal has a book about animal cognition. There's nobody, Tom, on the other side of this debate now. You know, when I started an animal advocacy group, in the mid-80s, a lot of people denied animal intelligence. Some people even denied animal suffering. The world has changed. Now there are basically no philosophers, no scientists on the other side who say animals don't matter.
Wayne Pacelli makes a strong claim in his book. He says, if you are part of the old, inhumane economic order, get a new business plan or get out of the way, you're already in danger of being too late. It's fascinating, Wayne, because it seems to me just a couple of decades ago, that would have sounded like the most toothless threat or observation. And it doesn't sound toothless now. Something's changing.
No, and a rising tide of consciousness about animals. I mean, now all 50 states have anti-cruelty statutes and make malicious cruelty a felony. So we have a universal value against animal cruelty enshrined in the law. The task that we're engaging in is how do we logically apply that anti-cruelty principle?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the president of the Humane Society of the United States, Wayne Pacelli, about what he sees as the emergence of a new humane economy, a kind of revolution underway where human society is just not so willing to exploit, hurt, abuse animals anymore for its own ends. His new book is The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers are Transforming the Lives of Animals. You can join us this hour. Do you see a more humane economy emerging around us? Do you study the label? Go online to see how your products are made if animals suffer in the making? And yes, should they have shot the gorilla in the Cincinnati Zoo? Lots of big changes. Wayne Pacelli cites some of them. Ringling Brothers, of course, has announced no more elephants. Under the Big Top, gentle giants would be phased out by 2018. Here's CEO Kenneth Feld calling it bittersweet. He's mixed here with the famed Ringling Brothers introduction.
The elephants have been on the circus for 145 years, but it's the best thing for our company and most of all for the elephants.
Welcome to the greatest show!
Greatest show won't have dancing elephants. In March, SeaWorld announced it would phase out the orca shows there and stop orca breeding. Here's a promotional video of that announcement.
This will be the last generation of orcas at SeaWorld. The company who helped the world fall in love with orcas will end all orca breeding and transition away from theatrical orca shows. The animals will continue to live at SeaWorld under world-class care where visitors can see them for years to come.
And big purveyors all over the place saying no more cage-free eggs. Not right away, but it's coming. Here's the ad from Denny's titled, The Chicken Comes Before the Egg.
So, we're free.
Yep, totally cage-free.
Totally cage-free.
Oh, I'm so excited.
You know, we could do anything.
Anything.
We could fly.
We can't.
Well, we could run.
Yeah, run.
Oh, I love running. Or maybe we could cross the road.
You did not just say that.
Today, Denny's is making a commitment by 2026 to get their eggs from cage-free chickens. What they do with their freedom is completely up to them.
2026, cage-free eggs. Wayne Pacelli, is that soon enough for you?
We'd like to have it happen very, very soon. Taco Bell is doing a phase-out of just 1 year. Some companies like Costco are just 2 or 3 years. The back-end deadline is about 10 years for some of these companies, but what's going to happen, Tom, is for 270 million laying hens jammed into cages where the birds are shoulder to shoulder and can barely move, those cages over the next 10 years will all be deconstructed and we'll have hens out of cages. We'll have leapfrogged Europe, which went to colony cages, larger cages, to allow the birds to move a little bit more. A lot of the eggs in Europe are already cage-free, but they've moved to these colony cages. We're just bypassing that entirely and going to a cage-free country.
But this is not the same as free range. This is not Grandpa's barnyard with a couple of hens clucking around all over the place.
That's right, and that's why consumers need to be alert on these issues. You know, we don't think this is the end of the story. This is the beginning of the story. It's the beginning of our understanding where our food comes from. Free range means that the animals are outside. They have access to pasture. Cage-free includes that, but it also includes animals being in a barn-type system or an aviary system where they're in a building for their entire life. So consumers who really want to give the animals enrichment, want them to experience the outdoors, they need to opt for free range.
What else are you looking for on the livestock front when it comes to how they're handled in food production? Cage-free, you're making progress on. Do you have other progress to report, or what are your next targets?
Well, the pig industry hasn't entirely submitted on this, but the big gains that we've made on the gestation crate issue are very notable.
Define that, please.
Sure. Gestation crates are 2-foot by 7-foot crates, so just, you know, as wide as our shoulders as people. And these are 300-400, 500-pound breeding sows, and they're in these cages or crates for up to 3 years, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 successive pregnancies. Pigs have a 4-month gestation period, and they're immobilized. So 75 or so of the biggest food companies have said we're going to stop buying pork from operations that confine the sows. But the pork
How much of American pork comes from that kind of gestation cage production?
The preponderance of the breeding. So the actual pigs that are raised for meat are in group housing situations, but it's the breeding sows, about 5 million of them, about 80% of them are now in these crates, and we want to get them out. And so many big companies have said this is what we're doing, including McDonald's, but also Safeway and Kroger. So we need to phase that out. The veal industry, many people recognize that issue as an iconic animal welfare issue, where the veal calves, these young male calves, were in a 22-inch wide crate.
Yeah.
By 2017, the entire veal industry is transitioning away from confinement. We expect, as another issue, Tom, the end of tail docking of dairy cows by 2017, where the farmers used to literally cut a large portion of the tail off. This is living tissue of the animals. Just as a traditional activity, they used to milk from behind and the tail would kind of swat them
a little
bit.
I've been swatted many times by those,
Yeah, so now we're ending that. All the veterinary associations say that this is unnecessary and it's inhumane. I think, you know, one of the big issues in industrial agricultural production is fast growth of broiler birds, the chickens raised for meat. They are growing so fast in such a short time that they're just unhealthy. They have chronic leg problems. They have heart problems. They have a number of other physiological problems that in some ways immobilize them. They're not in a cage or a crate, but they can barely walk, so it's de facto immobilization. We have really engineered through selective breeding this type of bird with big muscles and big body weight that grows so fast, and it's just a genetic and hereditary problem that really diminishes their lives and the quality of their lives.
Is there any change coming on that front?
Well, we're just starting to roll up this campaign.
Roll up means finish or
no,
roll out,
start. Yeah, to roll out, yes, to begin to really campaign and tell the public the backstory on this issue. Meanwhile, you know, what I also talk about in my book is that all of these entrepreneurs are now using plant-based proteins in different ways, and they're producing chicken-like products that mimic the taste and texture of chicken, all the protein, none of the downside, none of the antibiotics, none of the hormones, none of the chlorine, and we can have the same sort of gustatory experience, the same palate experience, but not involve the chicken at all. And I think this is where the other side of our change is occurring. It's not just that we are morally alert to animals and we're making better choices, but we're also seeing innovation that is giving us new options that we never had. You know, if Lewis and Clark were traversing the country in 1803, they didn't have supermarkets. They didn't have department stores. They had to kill to eat. They had to kill to clothe themselves. Now we have synthetic fiber coats and natural fiber coats that are just as stylish as fur, keep us just as warm. Why would you wear fur in this day and age when you have an alternative that's a functional equivalent, or it's even superior, and it's certainly superior from a moral perspective?
I've got big questions about the dynamics of this, but I don't want to lose track of the factual detail, because I think everyone listening is probably trying to weigh the reality of this, what you call the humane economy. Take us back for just a minute to pigs. Did you say that 80% of pigs for pork are born in gestation crates these days? And do you have any leverage on that? Do you see change coming in that or not?
Yeah, big change. So basically, we slaughter about 100 million pigs a year for food in the United States. And 5 million of the pigs that are housed on these farms are breeding sows. Mm-hmm. So after 4 months of pregnancy, then they produce a litter of piglets. Those piglets don't go into the crates. The mothers stay in the crates. And we've gotten about 75 of the biggest food retailers, McDonald's and Kroger and Safeway and Cracker Barrel, to make a commitment to phase out their purchase
by
of pork. Different timelines for different companies, but most of it's going to be done by 2022. We're trying to accelerate it. We actually have a ballot initiative in Massachusetts this November to stipulate no extreme confinement of veal calves, breeding sows, or laying hens, but also to stipulate that if you sell pork or veal or eggs in Massachusetts at all, those animal products must come from farms, wherever they may be, in Indiana, Massachusetts, Iowa, that honor that standard of allowing the animals to stand up, lie down, turn around, and freely extend their limbs.
If all 75 of those pork sellers go down this road, how much would it knock down that 80% of piglets born in gestation crates?
It would invert it. It would probably be only 20% remaining, but we're going to work on the rest of those companies, just as we have with the egg industry. We believe we've got about 90-95% of all egg sales covered with the agreements we've reached with major food sellers on the cage-free issue. We're probably at about 80% on the pork issue, so we have a number of other companies to line up. But I think what we've seen with the egg issue, we'll see with the pork issue, that there's just a cascade of announcements that flow. And you don't want to be the outlier in the humane economy. If so many other competitors of yours are saying, we're going to honor a minimum animal welfare standard, the companies that don't are going to look awful. And that's what's happening in our society. That's the humane economy forming before our very eyes.
You're right. Every day there's less room in our civic conversations for discredited ideas about animals existing for whatever use we humans concoct, and less tolerance for self-serving rationalizations for calculated cruelty. You say these old ways of thinking, you write, are being squeezed into oblivion from two sides. You've touched on that, but give us the pincer movement. What do you see happening?
Well, I see alternative housing systems for animals that give the animals better lives and that conform to our value system that animals built to move should be allowed to move. I also see entrepreneurs and businesses starting developing plant-based proteins that give us what we want in terms of taste and protein and other nutrients without really causing a sacrifice. You know, we humans have eaten meat for all of human history, but in a laboratory, in a production facility, in a manufacturing plant, if we can create what we desire in terms of the protein and the taste, and we can have a functional equivalent, why wouldn't we choose to do that? Or at least why wouldn't we choose to have a large portion of our diet be enhanced with those products? And, you know, that's where the pincer movement is coming, that we're getting more humane in terms of our farming practices by shedding extreme confinement, needless mutilations like tail docking, and we're also developing plant-based products that give us all that we want. You know, if it was 30 or 40 years ago, it would have been a sacrifice for us to eat these alternative products. Now it's not. It's a functional equivalent for us. There's a company I profile called Beyond Meat in the book, where they've developed new burgers that bleed and that look like the meat that we're so used to eating. And, you know, we have some of these at our events at the Humane Society, and some people say, oh my God, I didn't realize you were serving us meat. And it's a plant-based product, but it's so good. It's just like computers. They're getting better and better every year. And I think these entrepreneurs and companies are going to get better and better at providing palatable plant-based proteins for us.
I mean, some of these are plant-based, but others are not, right? You're also celebrating in here what I guess is sometimes called test tube meat.
Yeah, cultured meat. I mean, I did go and visit with Andres Forjax. He runs a company called Modern Meadow that's doing cultured meat. They're basically growing meat in a laboratory setting. Now, we already use cell division to grow insulin to treat diabetics. We're starting to grow organs in labs. This is not a fanciful, futuristic notion that we can grow tissue in a laboratory setting. We're already doing it. As we get better and better at this, for those people who actually crave the tissue, living tissue of animals, you can get it, but you don't have the fully formed organism with a brain and a heart and the bones and all of these other issues. And then you don't have all of the environmental problems. You know, it was more than 40 years ago that Francis Moore LePay, the author, called animals protein factories in reverse. If animals are not raised on grass, if cows and pigs are not eating grass, they're fed grains. And it may take 12 or 13 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, or 7 or 8 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of pork. That is enormously inefficient, and that's why she called these animals protein factories in reverse. So you have all of this use of grains in our society fed to animals who inefficiently convert that to animal protein. You have all of the waste that they produce. In the first hour of your show, you talked about the overuse of antibiotics.
Yes,
85% of all antibiotics used in our society are fed to animals on factory farms before they're sick. Antibiotics are not meant to prevent the onset of illness. They're designed to treat illness. And we're told not to use antibiotics, you know, randomly and casually. And it's the overuse of antibiotics that is a huge public health threat to us. So when you really take stock of factory farming, and you look at the enormous environmental problems, you look at the enormous animal exploitation and cruelty, and you look at the public health issues, to say nothing of the personal health issues of all the fat and cholesterol and all the heart disease and cancers, I mean, the intellectual case against factory farming is so airtight. And that's why, you know, we're seeing some of these changes that I'm talking about in our society.
Here's the CEO of Beyond Meat. You mentioned them. They talked to CBS a little while back about their mock meat, healthier for consumers. CEO Ethan Brown says,
"We can recreate meat with plant-based inputs entirely, so the texture and the taste is exactly the same. So at the end of the day, if you're having beef and chicken and it comes directly from plants with no cholesterol, no saturated fat, or no trans fat, it's better for you and it's better for the environment."
Wayne Pacelli with the Humane Society callers for you. Ben in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Ben. You're on the air.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Love this conversation. I think it's really important. One of my biggest, I own a vegetarian cafe, mm-hmm. and it's like one of my things is that you like seeing the actual farm where it comes from. I don't trust anything that's too cheap because food is just way too cheap these days. But also we do serve meat, and like the tradition of eating meat, I feel will always be a little important. And sometimes I find some of that weird made food, soy food, like doesn't have all the amino acids and like minerals and nutrients that real meat will have. So it's just interesting. And thank you for taking my call.
Wait, well, let me ask you, Ben, do you see this humane economy Wayne Pacelli is talking about taking hold when you look around in New Orleans? Are you seeing a lot of people saying, no, if animals suffer, I don't, that's not what I want to eat?
I think it's you know, so much meat gets eaten every day. It's insane. Yeah. It is. I'm I think things are changing, but it's gonna. There's just so much deep rooted tradition, especially in a place like New Orleans. But like I do feel like with just even like seeing the puppy videos and stuff on YouTube, there's like some serious connection. And like I said, I still eat meat myself, but it's more about like a moderation thing. Like you know, instead of meatless Mondays, it should be like meatless, you know, 4 days of the week or whatever, or mm-hmm. like meat two meals of the week or something, you know. I don't know. It's just really interesting, and the economy is so, like, there's just so much meat. It's just insane. But definitely, like, if I can't see where, like, the farm is, and it goes for vegetables too, like, there's something wrong with the production, either underpaid workers or, like, some chemicals or some weird crap. You pay for what you get, you know. And
we got it, Ben. You got a good eye on it there in New Orleans, and we really appreciate your call. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the president of the Humane Society of the United States, Wayne Pacelli, about what he sees as the emergence of a new humane economy, a kind of revolution underway where human society is just not so willing to exploit, hurt, abuse animals anymore for its own ends. The sound of wild orcas there from Orca Network. SeaWorld will no longer have those orca shows soon. Wayne Pacelli sees changes all over the place in medical testing, in the food we eat, in the way we handle animals and entertainment. He's got a new book out called The Humane Economy, and you can join us this hour. What do you think? Will this approach, this way of looking at things, change the world? Is it changing already? Are you more tuned in these days to what price animals may pay for your products, your pleasures? It's not just food we eat. They also pets are also something they care about. A Humane Society ad here from television urging people to give their local animal shelters their business and adopt stray animals when it comes time to find a pet.
There are thousands of dogs and cats housed in shelters that need your help. Local shelter professionals and volunteers give their heart and soul to help unwanted animals and deserve your support. Americans give millions every year to national animal organizations, but unless you give to your local shelter, you can't be sure that money will make it to the pets that need it most.
Medical research and training changes there as well. Just this month, Johns Hopkins University Medical School ended the use of live animals in their surgical training labs. Here's a news report from the local ABC affiliate in Baltimore, WMAR.
Students at Johns Hopkins will no longer operate on live animals. Student surgeries were performed on pigs under anesthesia, and then the animals were put down. Well, despite the popularity of the controversial course, a year-long review board determined it wasn't essential.
Wayne Pacelli writes in his book, "We need not accept the idea of routine cruelty in agriculture, entertainment, wildlife management, or any other part of our economy and culture." What do we see coming? The humane economy, he says. Wayne Pacelli in Washington, standby callers for you. Jenny in Madison, Wisconsin. Jenny, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. I just want to say I love this topic, and I'm really glad that it's being talked about. I have a few people in my life who are very religious, and they always come back with the argument that God put animals on the earth for people to eat and people to use. And I'm just wondering, what would be the best way to approach that topic with those people that really seem to not want to budge on the issue?
Wayne Pacelli?
We have a whole faith outreach program at the Humane Society of the United States. You can go to humanesociety.org/religion, and every major world religion talks about kindness and mercy and decency toward animals. The first animal rescue stories in the first book of the Bible where Noah saves two of everything. So biblical traditions, traditions in Judaism, traditions in Hinduism are all aligned on animal protection. And, you know, Adam and Eve were vegetarians in the garden.
And do you find, Wayne, that that's enough? I mean, you can put it that way, but you know that there are scripture verses that people quote right back to you.
Well, I just like in philosophy, there used to be, you know, a robust debate about whether we should care for animals, and now all of the major philosophers are aligned with animal protection. The same thing with animal scientists, unless they work for one of these industries. You know, any reputable scientist recognizes that animals feel and they think, they've got intelligence. And I think, you know, scholars in you know, various world religions all recognize that we have duties and responsibilities to animals. I think it's just about framing it. And, you know, we at the Humane Society don't so much talk about animal rights. We talk about human responsibility. It's really more about us and how we handle the immense power that we have over animals. Do we lord that power over them under the notion that might makes right, treat that power as license, or do we wield our power very carefully and responsibly? And, you know, that's really our message, is that we are unique. We are distinct as a species. Let's show our distinctiveness by being merciful toward all of the other creatures who share this planet with us.
You write about a groundswell among consumers who don't want to see animals suffer. What do you think is producing that?
I think it's a combination of the universal value of opposition to animal cruelty. That's enshrined in the law. Every state has laws against cruelty. We also have this rising tide of understanding about animal intelligence. You know, we now know that elephants grieve for their young. Chimpanzees engage in funeral processions when a member of their community dies. We think about crows and their use of tools and so many other creatures. You know, we can no longer deny that animals are intelligent. Then the third part of this is innovation. You know, if we've got a problem of animal cruelty that relates to fashion or food or science, let's figure it out. Let's figure out a better way to get the outcome we want in our society, to feed ourselves properly, to clothe ourselves, to get good insights in science, and let's just do it. That's what's happening in our society. A combination of moral intentionality with innovation and science is giving us options we never had before, and that's what I talk about in the humane economy.
A couple of areas beyond food that you write about, and we just heard about in the clips there. One, medical research, and we know that for a long, long time, animals were seen as key to that. Has the balance changed there in how animals are used to test drugs or for surgical experimentation training, as we heard there out of Johns Hopkins? They're stopping that?
Yes, I have a whole chapter about this in the book, and there are different categories of uses of animals in testing and research. And I think the use of animals in cosmetic testing is on its way out. Hundreds of companies now put a symbol on their product saying no animal testing. And companies that are still testing don't put a symbol saying we do animal testing because they realize that it's a problem for them of perception in the marketplace. On chemical testing, the Congress is just about to clear legislation to reform the Toxic Substances Control Act, which deals with regulating 85,000 chemicals in use. And there's language in there that's going to dramatically reduce the use of animals in chemical and safety testing. We can thank Senator Cory Booker for leading that charge, but it's been bipartisan support for this effort. On medical testing, it's a more complex situation, but I do talk about in my book how Dr. Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, and his predecessor have basically said that efficacy testing for drugs on animals is largely a failure, that the failure rate is 90% when we try to extrapolate these results. And I think he and others are talking about better science to give us important results. We need drugs. We need medical research. But let's find other ways to do it. That animals in so many ways are obsolete and in some ways have retarded our progress.
Pets, you write about them as well. This isn't high science. It's much more straightforward. But you've got some chains who are moving away from the traditional sources of puppies or kitties or all the rest. What do you see going on there?
Well, I credit PetSmart and Petco for, in the 1990s, adopting the model of opening up their stores, and now there are 2,500 of them between those two big brands in the pet supply world. They opened their doors to rescue groups and shelters to make homeless animals available. In fact, I talk about getting my dog Lily at a local PetSmart in Northern Virginia. And she had been pulled by a rescue group from a public shelter. She was about to be euthanized, and then she was adopted out at PetSmart. And through these adoption programs, where these companies are now part of the solution, 11 million dogs and cats have been adopted. It's been a big chunk out of the euthanasia problem. And there are other innovations that have occurred to drive down euthanasia. From the mid-1970s, we were euthanizing 15 to 20 million dogs and cats. Now it's about 2.5 million at a time when we have many more dogs and cats and many more people in our society. So it's real progress. We should get that down to zero. There's no reason for these healthy and treatable dogs and cats to be euthanized in shelters if more people choose adoption.
Steve writes to us by email and asks about the factory farm divestment movement. Can you describe that? How much traction does that have?
Well, there are big institutional investors, pension funds and banks and others who, you know, have the money of so many millions of Americans invested in companies. And there are now screens being set up by some of these institutional investors to get companies out of the business of factory farming. And a number of the major institutional investors have identified confinement systems and other factory farming practices as a risk factor for these companies. So whether it's Tyson or other big meat companies, if they still are clinging to that old model, it's a risk. And I think that we're going to see big pressure coming from these institutional investors because they want to have a minimum standard when it comes to animal welfare. It's another channel for the humane economy to show itself.
Marty's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Marty, you're on the air with Wayne Pacelli. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to note that it is becoming more and more difficult to really understand the practices of companies as they become purchased or bought out by larger companies. So if you do research on one company and think that they have responsible and humane practices, you're not always knowing that their parent company does not have those same practices, or perhaps they were purchased so that that company can have a different, you know, face, so that people may think that they are becoming more responsible when in fact they're not.
What about that, Wayne?
Big companies buying up environmentally or animal-friendly smaller companies, do the consumers still have leverage?
Well, yes, I think so. But, you know, in addition to having an animal protection ethic that we should have in looking at companies, we also need to value transparency. We need to really have these companies telling their story and really being honest. You know, we had to do a whole bunch of undercover investigations, and we still do undercover investigations at the Humane Society of the United States to penetrate these factory farms and to show how pigs are confined for 3 years in these 2-foot by 7-foot cages called gestation crates or laying hens.
Aren't you up against these laws that make it illegal to actually video or record what's going on there?
It's the backlash from agribusinesses. We show what's going on. They try to close the curtain, and we have had to fight in about 24 states these so-called ag gag laws that seek to criminalize our taking pictures or video of animals on the farms that supply hundreds of millions of consumers with food, or they make it a crime if you're an animal welfare advocate to seek a job at one of these slaughter plants or one of these factory farms. I mean, this is a grave threat, not just to the First Amendment, but to the safety of our food and to the transparency of our entire food production system. So we are mounting legal challenges, and of course we're playing defense in state legislatures, where lawmakers in a number of states, particularly in the Midwest, are just so devoted to these agribusiness interests, they carry their water for them.
You've got consumers perhaps behind you more than you've ever had. You bring that leverage to bear with companies to get them to change their policies. How does that work? Do they reach out to you for advice, or do you go in and grab them by the scruff of the neck and say, hey, you know, play ball with us by Humane Society's standards, or you're going to get a black eye?
We try to do things cooperatively, and we always want to give companies and individuals the chance to move in the direction of the humane economy. We go into that with that assumption. And we have so many great relationships with companies like Walmart and McDonald's and Burger King. I mean, these big brands used to be our adversaries, and now they are our allies.
Can we just test that for a second? You've got them to do cage-free by some distant year, but don't they still have a lot of factory farm meat, a lot of it going out? Your allies?
Yes, but you know.
So what kind of allies are they? What do you mean exactly?
They're allies that are beginning to embrace the notion of animal protection, that things don't change overnight. But when Walmart commits to the 5 freedoms of farm animal welfare, as it has as a company with kind of an ethical framework to source all of their animal products in a different way, that's a big commitment. We want to celebrate that change, even if it doesn't come overnight, even if it takes years to phase it in. That's the way the world works. And, you know, we have got a very big food supply that's been built around factory farming for decades. We're not going to unwind it overnight. And we've got to understand that these companies have a business model that they have to make workable. And it's going to take some time to turn this around. But we're working cooperatively with them. But there are times, Tom, that we will also use the stick. I mean, Publix, which is a big grocery company, it's the only one of the top 25 grocery companies that hasn't committed to phase out the purchasing of animal products from animals in extreme confinement. So we've got ads that are running in social media, on our website, that really wrap the knuckles of this company. We want it to change, but when it does, we'll celebrate that change.
Jose in Miami, Florida. Jose, you're on with Wayne Pacelli. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. My question is, what about all the animals are killing for religion rituals, like Afro-American, Afro-Cuban, you know, religions in Miami, Cuba, all over the United States?
Animals like what, Jose? You talking chickens or?
Chickens, all kinds of animals. Goats,
yeah.
You know, cats, everything. Fish,
turtles. Yeah. Jose, our time is short. Wayne Pacelli, what about it?
Animal sacrifice has been a big part of many religions for a long time, but in Christianity and so many other religions, it's been shed. In fact,
not entirely.
No,
you might still have the Paschal lamb.
Yes. We announced last year the biggest ritual animal sacrifice in the world in Nepal, where 500,000 animals are killed, is ending. We worked with clerical leaders in Nepal to end that. It happens every 5 years. It's called the Gadamai Festival. We don't think that animal sacrifice should be part of any religion, and obviously we respect the diversity of religious thought, but it should shed the idea of animal sacrifice, just like we wouldn't accept religions that exploited women or people or children. It's just certain things are just beyond the pale, and religious freedom should not be an excuse to exhibit animal cruelty.
Are you halfway there when it comes to seeing a humane economy in this country, let alone the whole world? Are you at 10% of the way, 1% of the way? How do you see it?
It's a great question, Tom. I'm not sure. I think what I argue in the book is that by campaigning strategically and by tapping into this growing consciousness of the American public, we can make progress. I've shown in different sectors of the economy that we are making very substantial forward movement. Where we are, whether we're 10% or 30%, I'm not sure. There's still so many calamitous situations for animals. We've got a lot of work to do, which is why we want people to be involved with our work.
Wayne Pacelli is president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. His new book is The Humane Economy. Wayne Pacelli, good luck. Thank you very much for being with us today. Everybody's watching. Not all have exactly the same interest, but it is a very interesting evolution of how people see things, how the economy works. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Maeve Pages. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. This is On Point.